Welcome back to the Dying to Ask podcast. Doing something today that I've been wanting to do for the last 6 months, and that is basically book the easiest podcast guest ever. All I had to do for today was basically yell across the room and say, "Hey, Mike, what are you doing Wednesday?" We're talking today to Mike Lurie, one of my colleagues here at KCRA3. So Mike has been a journalist, as he puts it, since way back before Al Gore invented the internet. If you don't know what I'm talking about, Google it. It's kind of funny. He is one of the smartest, best prepared people, seriously, that I've ever worked with. He sits about 15 feet away from me in the newsroom. And one of the best parts of my day, and I haven't told Mike this, is when he goes to his desk right around 10 o'clock each day after he's been assigned to a story, and he starts working the phones. Because listening to Mike work his sources is a true thing of beauty. People will move their days around to make time for him because they know Mike Lurie is going to treat them right and tell their story with the kind of context that, honestly, only somebody who has decades of experience really can. I always tell the interns around here, go hang by Mike Lurie's desk. Don't talk to him. Don't interrupt him if he's busy. Just listen to how he talks to people. Mike is also somebody who completely fits our Dying to Ask mantra because he once took an idea and made it into a reality. When Mike's son was a teenager, he had this idea, because they love baseball, to go to every single baseball park in the country together. It took them years, but ultimately, their father-son road trips became a book. It's called Baseball Between Us, 16 years, 32 ballparks, 43,000 miles, a roadmap to a winning father-son relationship. So it's part memoir, Mike tells some great news stories, part parenting book, but it's really the ultimate guy's road trip, and it teaches you a lot about what it's like to watch your kid grow up and then eventually move on. So on this Dying to Ask, Mike is going to tell some of the new stories that he always gets asked to tell at cocktail parties, what he's learned about following your passion when he actually burned out on the news business a few years back, and he got out of news for a few years. Now, obviously, he came back, so clearly it wasn't a great move, but he learned a lot through the experience. And then also the lessons learned from the ultimate father-son road trip and his advice to the rest of us who are just trying to make connections with our kids before they leave. Here's Mike Lurie, my dear friend and incredible colleague on Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Hey, Mike Lurie, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is really fun. Do you know, as I was in my rabbit hole of Mike Lurie research, it's funny how things like jog your memory.
Uh-huh.
And I remember my first day at KCRA and meeting you.
Really?
Do you know why?
No.
Because you hit me up for a license plate.
Oh. It's very competitive, you know, because Larry Blitstein, one of our photographers, is also into collecting license plates. So I always have to get to the new people first.
But I remember you came here like, "Hi, you're from Iowa?" "Yep, that's where I was. Do you have a license plate?" I'm like, what kind of a weird place have I come to?
Yeah. And I still have your license plate in my garage.
Do you really?
Yeah.
And then it's funny, Larry, who you had mentioned, had come at me later on looking for the same thing. I'm like, I just gave it to one of the mics, because at the time we had like 17
right,
people named
right.
Michael who worked here. So anyway, that was one of my very first memories, actually, of meeting you
How
way
funny.
Back then, which was a long, long time ago.
It was.
How long have you been at KCRA?
Well, I first started in 1984, you know, back before Al Gore invented the internet. I was here for 15, almost 16 years, and then
back
I left.
Back when podcasts were called AM radio?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Left for a number of years and then came back in 2012. So altogether, 23 years.
Yeah. And then before that, where were you working?
I was in television news in San Antonio, Texas for 2 years, West Palm Beach, Florida for 2 years before that, and then radio in various parts of the country.
Yeah. And then you had worked as an investigative reporter for
uh-huh.
a while of that too, right?
I did investigative in San Antonio. That was sort of my exclusive focus, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And so what drew you into that kind of work?
That was what the opening was, and I thought it might be fun to kind of delve.
That was the job
so,
was available.
Okay, I'm going to be an investigative reporter.
Yeah, that's what I do.
I had done some investigative reporting in West Palm Beach. I had actually done a 5-part series on the Ku Klux Klan in Florida, which was surprising that they were that visible. This is back in the early 80s.
Right.
And one day I was coming home from work, and I saw all these guys in white sheets with hoods over their heads at an intersection in the middle of the day.
Seriously?
Yeah. And they were out there collecting money. They were getting donations at a red light. Yes.
It was like a GoFundMe for the Klan?
Yeah, exactly. I was pretty surprised. Growing up on the East Coast, I had never seen that before. So they were handing out, you know, flyers, and I said, okay, I'll grab a flyer and look into it more. So I got a flyer, contacted them, got a call mysteriously one Sunday night saying, we're happy to meet with you. And one thing led to another.
Come
and
I alone. Ended up doing,
yeah, a 5-part series on the KKK.
Wow. That's really interesting. And so I'm just curious. Sorry, I'm going back down that Mike Lurie rabbit hole. But so what happened? Did you actually go out to?
We did. I wanted to attend some of their activities. They took us to a cross burning, which I had never been to before. It was very scary, very frightening. They took us also to, well, at that cross burning, there were a bunch of guys with semi-automatic rifles, you know, all in a circle. And I was there with my photographer, and we were all alone, along with 35 Klansmen.
Wow.
So that was probably not very smart, you know, now that I look back.
In retrospect.
Anything could have happened. Luckily, nothing did. But we went to a lot of their activities, and then we did interviews with them, and they ended up sounding and looking so stupid on camera that they kind of dissolved briefly after that.
I would have worried that they might have come after you at that point.
I was a little worried.
Isn't it weird? Because you think about that kind of thing now and how we would cover something like that now versus back then. I mean, it was you and I assume a photographer going off on your own to some you know, clandestine meeting. And, you know, hopefully you come back in a few hours. Now, like, we would go so wired up with different cameras.
Oh, yeah.
And we would stream it. And we would probably do a poll on should Mike go to the...
Right.
Should Mike go hang out with the Ku Klux Klan?
Right, you know? Exactly.
Such a different world.
Everything on social media, you know, with, you know, putting it on the iPhone and, you know, putting it on Twitter and Facebook and all of that while you're there just to promote it, which is today's metrics, but very different back then, where all we had in the car was a two-way radio with the news director talking to us back and forth. Where are you now? I don't know. It's dark. We're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that, and you had your Rand McNally, you know, atlas to guide you to wherever you were trying to get to.
Thomas Brothers Guide.
Thomas Brothers, yeah. Do you look back at those days, like early on? Like, I always tell people, this job used to be a lot harder because you didn't have all the answers in your phone. Like, for example, before we started recording this, I couldn't get one of the cameras to work. So I'm like, oh, hold on a minute. Let me go Google this to see if I can figure out how to get this camera going. Like, now, I mean, you can kind of get a lot of aid along the way. You can get a context. You can get the history. Back then when you started, and even not that long ago, you had to be so much more, I think, resourceful in this job.
Well, there was a lot of, you know, old-fashioned digging, going to the county courthouse and digging through records.
You still do that.
I do.
Yes, you do.
Old-fashioned.
I sit close enough to your desk. I hear you doing that all day.
You know, everyone else has got things electronically. I like to print things out just because I can see it better and visualize it. But
We meet at the printer a lot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I like the old-fashioned gumshoe of, you know, going and digging and, you know, being in a research library and looking through documents and finding things that have been there for, you know, decades. And today it's much different. Everything's on the internet. Click of a button and boom, there it is. So very different dynamic.
We had an intern who was in recently and I pointed her in your direction and she was kind of watching. I said, if you're interested in politics, you need to go head over and spend some time with Mike Lurie. He'll show you how to do it. And so she sat back and I think just kind of eavesdropped as you were doing things. She says, he's very old school. I said, that's not old school. That's just good reporting. There's a difference. But it's funny because like those techniques and things you were mentioning, I think some people look at and they go, oh, well, that's how it used to be. No, like really good reporting is a combination of all of it. And it's not just looking at the work other people have done online. It's getting into that phone and pulling out the people who you've probably known for 30 years and asking them to connect you with two phone calls, you know, to somebody
exactly.
else.
I still think the essential ingredient for being a good reporter is contacts, connections, being able to connect with people when you need them in a hurry, who can are reliable, trustworthy, good, credible sources who will give you information that you can count on. And that's something that you don't get in a Google search or on Facebook or Twitter, because who are these people? You don't know them. They're unreliable. But when you have sources that you've been working with for years and years, you can really get some good intel.
Yeah. How did you become a reporter? What drew you to it?
I started in radio, college radio, being a disc jockey. I loved music and spinning discs. Remember the days of vinyl?
Yeah, 100%.
Right. So I really enjoyed doing that, and I wanted to get a job in radio. That was my passion. That was my dream. And, you know, with radio, you know how it is. They change formats, like Kleenex. One day you're country, the next day you're rock, the next day you're off the air. So knowing that, I figured, well, maybe the one stable part of the business was news, because every FM rock station still had a news department, at least at the time.
It was usually like two people.
Two people.
One in the morning.
Right,
one
right
in the
exactly.
afternoon.
And or sometimes one.
Right.
and I thought, well, that might be fun to do it. And you do it sort of in an alternative style that's a little bit more hip and trendy. But still, you know, you're getting the information. You're still covering the county courthouse.
Did you have a disc jockey name?
No, I just used my own name.
Okay.
A lot of people did. But
yeah, they did.
Yeah. Did you have one?
No, I didn't have a name long enough because I moved. I ended up moving from Star 102.5, the best of yesterday and today. I moved over to KFRU Radio, where I had a really great opportunity to work in News Talk Radio.
I was
in college, and I had, you know, for a woman, had a really deep voice.
Uh-huh.
And so this little chain of radio stations I was working at, I got to move into News Talk Radio. So from 3 to 6 every day, I co-hosted an afternoon drive show with lots of interviews that were in it, which was my first real opportunity.
What market was that?
This was in Columbia, Missouri.
Wow.
So I had a full-time radio job while I was going to school, and I worked with a guy named David Lyle, who I think in retrospect was probably, well, I thought he was ancient. He wasn't. But at the age of 20, I thought he was, of course. Uh-huh. But, you know, David had, you know, easily 15 years experience on me and was the most patient partner. And, you know, most of the time people didn't know how young I was until I said something that would, of course, betray the fact that I was 20 years old.
Right.
But it was a great, great job.
What a fantastic
because I got
experience.
To talk to people.
Yeah.
You know, and that was at the heart of it. That's really what we do.
Uh-huh.
That's what this is. You're
Absolutely.
Just talking to people
right.
and stories come out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you went from radio then. Did you study journalism?
I did not. I just sort of paved into radio because that was my passion. That was my excitement. And I thought, I got to get a job in this industry somehow. So I did some radio news. After graduating from college, my first job was in San Luis Obispo. I was at KZOZ-FM, a 29,500-watt rock powerhouse in the Central Coast. I was the news director.
So you went from Connecticut, growing up on the East Coast, to living in San Luis Obispo?
Yeah, because I went to school in Southern California. I went to Pomona College in Claremont, about 35 miles from Los Angeles. And that was the first job that opened up, and I took it, and I was the news director in a news department of one.
Did you like your boss?
Well, yeah, he was okay.
Good-looking guy.
Didn't pay much, though. In fact, I remember my pay was $500 a month.
Wow.
$500 a month. And I
did you feel rich?
I thought it was great. I thought that was terrific. And but the problem was my rent was $500 a month. But I was living in an old 85-year-old California ranch house. Luckily, I had two other roommates, so we split the rent. So it was $133 each and a lot of beans and spaghetti, you know?
Yeah. What was the best part of starting out in journalism for you?
I think just the excitement of being able to meet people and, you know, being on the go and, you know, seeing all these newsmakers. I got to interview Jane Fonda when she came to town talking about nuclear power and, you know, whatever benefit was going on or, you know, demonstration and just being in the central, right there in the thick of it. It's like you have a window in the seat of history.
Yeah.
And that was exciting.
And so what do you think kept you committed to it? Because it is an industry, and even back then it was, with a really high burnout because it's hard. It's not an easy career like you know, a lot of other one. So what was it about it that you think kept you in for so long?
You know, I just enjoyed, I think, the curiosity, finding things out on a daily basis and being able to look for things and get reactions and meeting figures that you never would meet otherwise without being in the industry. I remember one internship I did back in Hartford. They sent me out to go interview a guy named Lowell Weicker, who was a senator from Connecticut at that time, but he was also a candidate for vice president when Gerald Ford was president. And so I asked him about, you know, what do you think about being VP? And he was like, oh, well, you know, it probably won't happen, but I'm flattered to be asked. But I never would be in a room with Lowell Weicker, you know, prior to that. And I thought, this is exciting. This is, you know, finger on the pulse of what's going on. I want to do more of it. And then radio eventually transitioned to TV.
And so how did you end up in Sacramento?
Well, I started doing TV consulting in a firm called Frank Maggot Associates in Iowa.
I'd forgotten you had done that.
Yeah, for about a year.
So explain to people what Maggot was and is.
Yeah, they're a TV consulting firm. They, you know, consult with their news consultants for dozens of stations across the country, and they try to improve their techniques through writing, looking at the composition of the newscast and the flow of it and the chemistry and how people are interacting and whether the live shots are fun and compelling or boring and not very good. So they do research based on the market and what people are wanting to see. And then they also talk about good journalism and what will actually get you better ratings by being a better storyteller.
So was your job then to help critique people and help them get better?
I did critiques. I wrote critiques on various newscasts and learned a lot about television news. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I can do this too. So I put some resume tapes out there and got a call from West Palm Beach, Florida.
And that's how you got into TV.
And that's how I got into it. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good place to start. You know?
And then you were hanging out with the Klan.
Yeah, exactly. Who knew? And then they pay you in sunshine.
Yes. Well, there is that. That's what I hear. So when you ended up in Northern California, mm-hmm. I mean, like this, I would say, like, if you can get to a destination station and you can make a home at a right. station, it's really great. Because there are people in our business who every 3 years they're flip-flopping and they're chasing the job with the ultimate goal of going to a network. And then the lucky ones find a home. And if you can find a really great city that for you is a good home, but also is a really good fit for your style and just for your lifestyle and your family, mm-hmm. then you win.
Right.
Because then you can really build a career. And for you, Sacramento became that.
Absolutely. And it didn't start out that way. I thought just like everybody else, you do 2 to 3 years.
2 years
in
the market.
And I'm out. Yeah, 3 to 5 and we're gone, you know, because I had done that West Palm Beach 2 years, San Antonio 2 years, Sacramento 3 to 5. But it turns out this is a really great place to live and to work. In terms of, a city, raising a family here, this is a great place, one of the few affordable cities left mm-hmm. in California, where you can actually have a backyard, you know, and that's kind of nice. But beyond that, the station was the epicenter, you know, to be able to work for a legacy station that really makes a difference, that, you know, is truly the place where the news comes first, and the resources that we have with Livecopter 3 and all the, institutional knowledge with all the reporters that we had and photographers. I learned so much. I was like a sponge. I just absorbed it and said, this is a great place to live and work.
What was the craziest thing that you got sent to? What's the one you always tell people at a cocktail party?
Well, you know, I used to do Call 3, which was the consumer action hotline. We ended up investigating a lot of consumer problems.
Mike was like the guy who like banged on doors.
Yeah.
Like, how many doors do you think you banged on?
Dozens.
Way more than that.
Yeah, way
like
more than
that. Like
in
a week, maybe. But you were like the guy, like people would call up and we mm-hmm. had these volunteers, which a lot of stations did back then.
Yeah.
And they would say, hey, you know, I went down to, I got my oil change
right.
and they put in like old oil or something random. And then
right.
you would like figure out if there was something to it.
Yeah.
And then try to like go for some justice.
Exactly. And sometimes that justice is getting answers from people who don't want to talk to you. And if it's a public official, you want to be very vigilant and try to get that information. But sometimes they're private businesses and they just don't want to talk to you. So you knock on the door, you call, you be a pest, you're trying to get their side of the story. And, you know, I always like to joke that, you know, in my career, I've been, you know, spat upon, cursed upon, thrown out of offices. And that was just from the assignment desk. but one time, to answer your question, we had a business that was in Carmichael, and they were a repair shop, basically, for washers and dryers and things like that. People would bring in their items and hope to get it repaired. But the problem is, they didn't get it repaired. They would stay there for weeks and weeks and weeks, so people were upset. So we went to go investigate the business, and the guy opens up the door and says, oh, yeah, we were expecting you. Hey, just a minute. And he goes out to the back room, and then he comes out, and he stands in front of a grand piano, and he starts banging out Lady Madonna. And I thought, how weird is that? But he went through the whole song and said, that's all I have to say. And he went away.
And you had the whole thing on camera.
That was it. We got it
that's
all on camera.
Awesome.
And we used it. So that was unusual.
That's funny. Did you get to a point, though, where like people would see you show up and they're like, all right, I give
yeah.
up?
Yeah. They.
Which
you know,
is a compliment, but at the same time, probably some of the fun has gone from stuff like that, too.
Well, yeah, because it's like, oh, my God, you're here. What's wrong? You know,
what have I done?
We don't want to talk to you. You try not to take it personally. You know, it's not about you, but you want to make sure you get their side of the story. But, you know, after a while, I was happy to make the transition to do more political reporting and general assignment news and show up in situations where people are actually happy to see you.
Yeah. I remember at one point you did actually get out of the business for mm-hmm. a while. What made you get out for a while?
I had been doing it for a long time, and I thought, you know, maybe it's time for a change. And I had an opportunity to work for the state through the Department of Consumer Affairs. So it seemed like a natural fit, a natural segue. And I enjoyed it, but you know, there was a lot of meetings, and there's a lot of
a lot of meetings.
It's a different pace of life. You know how it is in TV news. Everything is fast, fast, fast. Got to happen right away. You know, you come in the morning at 8:30, you pitch a story, it's on the news, it's on the air at 5 o'clock. Well, state working for the state doesn't work like that at all. It's, let's have a meeting. Mm-hmm, yeah, good idea. Well, let's come back in 3 weeks and discuss it some more. And, you know, it just gets put off and put off and put off. And eventually you lose momentum. And I found that it was a lot of, you know, too many meetings.
Yeah. Did you miss it right away? Because I think for people, if you last in this past a certain amount of time, it goes beyond just being a job. I mean, it's kind of a calling. It's kind of a curse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, It's just something you can't not do. Like, did you know that right away? Because I'm curious, because a lot of people who are in careers wonder when it's time, especially if you've vested a lot of time, to make that kind of a pivot. I think my producer, Jeff,
did recently. Exactly. You know, you got to find out what floats your boat, what excites you. But for me, it went from bad to worse because I went from TV news, which I loved, to state government, which was very slow and methodical. And then I thought, well, let me transition to something else. And I got into public relations. And that was, for me, not a good fit because PR is really about billable hours. And you got to be a rainmaker. Go out there, get the clients, bill them, get them in the door. And that's not my natural skill set, is being a salesman. So I quickly, you know, got out of that after a couple of years and transitioned back into TV news. So I was like the salmon that swam upstream, you know, came back to where I felt comfortable.
And to be fair, I mean, for all our state workers and PR people who are listening right now, this is just finding your own thing and finding what floats your own boat and what really works for you.
I mean, those are great careers for a lot of people. It just wasn't me.
What did you learn about just like following your passion during that time? Because at that time, your kids were also getting older. So I'm sure that they were watching you and probably learning as they were making decisions about their lives, about like maybe what they wanted to do.
Right. And it's funny you mentioned that about follow your passion. That's the one thing that I've learned, is sort of the key central lesson in life, if you will, that if you're passionate and enthusiastic about what you do, you'll be successful. And it doesn't even feel like work. It feels like you're having fun. And oh yeah, they're paying me for it too, which is exciting. Yeah. And I wasn't getting that thrill in the other careers, but when I was back in TV news, it just felt right.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. All right. So the other thing that's interesting about being in a newsroom, at least for me, is that a lot of what I've learned about just kind of, I guess what the kids would call now, adulting. Mm-hmm. I learned being in a newsroom because I was pretty young when I even got into KCRA. So I learned from a lot of the more veteran reporters and photographers. And one of the things that I didn't realize I was absorbing along the years was raising kids. Mm-hmm. Because I found that being in the front seat of a Ford Explorer for 8 hours straight,
right.
I was listening to photographers on the phone with their spouses talking about kids.
Right.
I was listening eavesdropping, I guess, to issues that they were going through with their kids, but also a lot of like the triumphs too and the celebrations.
Right.
And the same thing talking with people like you. And I remember years and years ago, you had this incredible experience with your son and you wrote a book called Baseball Between Us, which is a wonderful book. And we'll link to it. We'll link to the heck out of it. But you made this decision to connect with your kid in a really unique way. So can we talk a little bit about your book and
about how
that all came up? Because I now have a teenager, Mike.
Uh-huh.
And I'm there. So I don't know what my thing is.
I feel your pain.
I know you do. Everybody who's there does. But where did Baseball Between Us come from?
You know, it didn't start off as a book. It started off as an adventure. I've always loved baseball ever since I was a little kid. My dad used to take me to games at Yankee Stadium when I was growing up. And I always thought, you know, maybe one day if I have a family, I'd like to do that too. So when my kids, my daughter and son were young, I took them to the A's games and the Giants games. And we had lots of fun and they enjoyed it. And I thought, you know, maybe as they get older, I'll want to take them on the road and do an actual road trip. Well, my daughter
was it about baseball, though?
What's that?
What was it about baseball for you? Was it the nostalgia you had from spending time with your dad?
I think so. I think that was a lot of it, you know, and I just remember the thrill of going to Yankee Stadium for the first time and seeing this big cavernous stadium that I had seen on TV, and all of a sudden it was there, not in black and white, but in real color with green grass and the smell of popcorn and, you know, peanuts in the air and just all the noises and the sounds. It came alive, and it just thrilled something deep inside of me that this was the epicenter of my world and where I wanted to be, because I loved baseball so much, and it was just my primal connection with my dad. And just something that I loved to do as a kid. And he taught me how to switch hit, lefty and righty. And so it sort of took off from there.
Yeah. So you start the adventure.
Yeah, we started the adventure when my daughter was into ballet. So she was on the road all the time, you know, doing performances. I probably saw her perform the Nutcracker 38 times. that was her thing, you know. But she, you know, let me go on this trip with my son, who is more attuned to baseball. And I thought, well, let's do a road trip. Let's see what happens when we actually go to a city. And I planned 3 or 4 games in a row in different cities that we were going to fly and drive to and do the father-son bonding experience.
And how old is he at this point?
He was about 13 or so.
That's where I am
right
now.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm taking notes.
And if you've ever been in the room, you know, in a hotel room with a teenager for a week, it can be hell on wheels.
Yeah.
It
Did can he have be... a cell phone back then?
Oh,
probably
no.
Not.
No, no cell phones.
See, you had it better.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they can't tune out. They can't go into their own world.
They can ignore you still.
But that's true. But the flip side of it is that you have to interact together and sometimes you have fights. And we had some big fights.
Really?
Over everything from wake up time to music on the radio, especially the music. Because I love to listen to, you know, like rock stations and, you know, Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers and Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And my son would say, Dad, those guys are all dead. Why why are we listening to them? I want to listen to other musical artists like 50 Cent and Nelly. And we got into fights over that because I'm not really into rap music that much. We have a whole chapter about that.
Yep.
And funny things started happening along the way. And I, you know, being a journalist, I always kept a journal. So I would just sort of write down conversations like, well, you never believe what Matt said today. And I would write it down, still not thinking it was a book. But after a while, you know, we had so many anecdotes, I thought, maybe this could be something.
It's really interesting because these days, probably you would have been documenting it on Facebook.
Of course.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so you're documenting this along the way. And how long did these adventures go on? And when did you get the goal of trying to go to every park?
So we went to, I think it was Kansas City first. We flew out there, rented a car, went from Kansas City to St. Louis, and then we drove up to Chicago, and then I think we went to Cincinnati, Cleveland. It was just a massive road trip, but it was about a week and a half, something like that, and he liked it. I liked it. We survived. I said, you want to do it again next summer? Yeah, sure. Okay, let's do it. And I thought, okay, great. Same time next year. So we did that. And then I kept just keeping my notes and figuring at some point, I guess the pivotal point was we got to meet a guy named Maury Wills, who was a baseball player for the Los Angeles Dodgers back in the day. And he was always one of my heroes growing up. I loved him as a player. Even though I was a Yankee fan, I appreciated his talents. But he was in North Dakota, of all places. We were in Fargo because that was the birthplace of Roger Maris, who was a Yankee great.
Sure.
And we went to his gravesite, you know, to go see all the baseballs that were piled up there on his grave. And it turns out that Maury Wills was working with a minor league team called the Fargo-Moorhead Redhawks. And he was one of their advisors there, and we got to meet him, and he was just really gracious and very nice and took some pictures, and I thought, you know what? Maybe there is a book here.
Yeah. Did you share that with your son at that point?
Like, about being in a book?
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't take it seriously. He was like, yeah, whatever, you know, the flippin' stage. This was the stage where, and we have a chapter about this too, he decided to sort of tweak me by everything was – he was calling me by my first name. So instead of, yeah, Dad, whatever you want, it's like, okay, Mike, if you insist, you know, and I'm like, that's not my name. My name is Mike to my friends, but you're my son, so you can call me Dad. And he goes, that's so old-fashioned, Mike. And I said, you know, it shows respect when you say Dad. He goes, you know what? Just get over it. And so he knew how to push my buttons
right.
at the time. It was like, I'm going to show disrespect to my dad by calling him by his first name, like I'm his equal.
Yeah.
And so I thought the best thing to do was just to kind of disengage on that and not let him push my button. Just like, okay, whatever, you know. And I let him call me that for like 2 or 3 days. And then it just sort of faded away. It was not a thing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get the rise out of me. So passed that test.
When did you realize kind of the opportunity that you had through these trips? Because even in that downtime, even when a kid is just being atrocious to you,
right.
there are those moments of connection where you're like, it's working.
Yeah.
You know?
It took a long time to get there. I'll tell you an anecdote real quickly about something that happened that sort of shined the light. So I always try to weave in historical and political things on these trips.
Kids love that.
Yeah, they hate it. So I always take
they just love teachable moments.
Oh, yeah, teachable moments. Yes, Larry, we're doing that again. So everywhere we'd go, I always try to go to a state capital. So we went to the Wisconsin state capital. We went to the Minnesota state capital. You know, and, of course, he was bored to tears, but I'm trying to teach him political history. And we were in Milwaukee, I remember, for a Brewers game. And just by luck, total coincidence, in the lobby of the hotel, there's a plaque there. And it said, on this very spot, Teddy Roosevelt was nearly assassinated in 1912. He was making a speech at the time, and some guy came out of the audience and shot him. And he had a big speech, like a 50-page thick speech in his breast pocket. And it deflected the bullet enough so that it didn't kill him. Huh. But the bullet was still inside of him. And he actually made a comment at the time, because he survived, and he said, it takes a lot more than that to kill a bull moose, because he was the bull moose president. And I told that story to Matt. I said, see, you're learning a little bit about history. And he said, Dad, what's the big deal? Teddy Roosevelt was shot one time. 50 Cent was shot 9 times. That's much cooler than that. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. How do you compete with that?
How many years did the trips go on?
It took, it started when he was about 13, or actually 15, 16 or so, and it finished when he was 21, and we could actually have a beer at the ballpark together.
Wow.
And that was a pivotal moment. It actually happened a little earlier than that, and we're not breaking any laws here, but we went to Canada. And guess what? The drinking age in Canada is 19.
Yeah, and suddenly Dad was cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we went to Canada. We were in Toronto and I said, okay, Matt, I'm going to take you for your first legal beer. And he goes, yeah, okay. And we go to the restaurant and he orders a Stella, you know, like he knows what he's talking
right.
about. And he orders me a Molson. And I said, oh, yeah, that was pretty good. And he goes, yeah, and it was really great. I didn't even have to use my fake ID.
Classic.
I said, you have a fake ID? Yeah, but I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. I love the book because the book is on, you know, you kind of tell it chronologically and you go through the parks. And, you know, for somebody who loves baseball, there's lots of great, like, baseball stuff in there in terms of, like, what they were doing at the parks and, you know, funny stories.
Yeah.
And then the history gets woven in. One of my favorite things was reading the chapter that your son wrote at the end.
Oh, yeah, the epilogue.
Did you have any input on that at all? Or did he
No.
just present it to you and maybe describe a little bit of it? Because to me, that was like, okay, it was worth it.
Yeah. I asked him if he wanted to do that. I said, you know, this has been my voice throughout, but, you know, you've learned a lot, hopefully, you know, over the past 5 years or so. Would you like to write, you know, a little epilogue to the book? Just, you know, your perspective, your takeaway, your chance to get back at me for all the jokes and funny things that happened along the way where I'm making fun of you. And he goes, yeah, I'll write something. And he did. And it ended up being, I think, like you said, probably the best chapter of the book, that he talked about all the challenges of, you know, living with Dad in a hotel room for a week at a time. And as a teenager, that's not always fun. But he also learned some things, too. And it made me feel like maybe this was worth it. Maybe this was, you know, a rewarding thing for him and that he got something out of it. And I know that it bonded us closer together.
Do people ask you about this a lot in terms of, you know, trying to find their own thing?
Because
it is kind of, I know you didn't set out to write a parenting book, but that is kind of maybe just because of where I am in my life, I kind of read it as that.
Well, I wanted to make it a more universal experience for people that weren't hardcore, you know, baseball fans.
And you don't have to be.
Right.
To enjoy it.
And one of the things, you know, in one of the chapters in my book is that my wife, you know, went with us for some of the trips, and she hates baseball.
She does.
She hates baseball.
She must really love you, though.
Yeah, well, she does it to tolerate it, you know, but she'll say baseball's like watching paint dry, you know, because that's about how exciting it is for her. There's a funny little story. I took the kids when Sarah was in college and at USC, so we were all there for Parents Weekend. I said, let's do something fun. Let's go to a Dodger game. And they're like, yeah, of course, Dad's going to say that, right? Or actually, no, sorry, it was an Angels game. So we were going to go to Anaheim. So we all got in the car. And of course, we got in this big, huge cluster traffic jam on I-5 going down to Anaheim. And I have this thing about always wanting to be right there in time for the first pitch. First pitch
well, okay,
is
okay, you're one of the
for
first
me.
Pitch guys. What is it about the first pitch? Because I look and I go, there are 9 innings. That's
right.
A lot of baseball.
Right.
What is it that's so sacred about the first pitch?
A lot of times it's ceremonial. There's actually somebody that comes out and delivers the ceremonial first pitch. It could be a mayor or a civic person, someone that's being honored. But to me, it's just being there as part of the fabric of the game and seeing everything being prepared beforehand with the raking of the dust and the field and the watering of the lines.
It's all perfect.
Everything's perfect.
It's
exactly.
Perfect.
It's totally perfect. And there's all, you know, nothing on the scoreboard. It's an unpainted, you know, masterpiece. So for me, being there for the first pitch is essential as part of the game experience. Well, this wasn't going to happen in Anaheim because we were horribly late and stuck in this traffic jam. And so it's like 5 minutes before game time and we're still in the parking lot. And there's like 20 minutes to get into the lot. And I said, okay, Carol, take over. I'm running to the game. I want to go in and get my seats. Here's your tickets. I'll meet you there. And she's like, are you nuts? But I ran and everyone knew that, you know, Dad has to be there for the first pitch.
And you made it.
I made it. But the best part of the story is The Yankees were playing, the Yankees, my team, were playing the Angels, so I couldn't miss that. And I'm, you know, the first inning goes by and, you know, the pitchers are pitching like perfect games, striking out everybody. It's 0-0 at the end of the first, but no family. Where are they? Where are they? I'm texting away at this point, getting, you know, we're in the parking lot. Okay, great. Second inning, we're in the parking lot. Third inning, we're getting food, you know, and they're still not at their seats. So finally, they come in the middle of the fourth inning. And Carol comes up and says, what's the score? And I say, well, as you can see on the scoreboard, it's still nothing, nothing. She said, you see, we didn't miss a thing.
That's a great line. That's a great line. So for people who say, you know, Mike, I need to make that connection with my kid, my kids, but I'm not into baseball, much like your wife. What do you tell people about that kind of time in that life? Because you have that time when your kids are young, when you are amazing, because they don't know any better.
Right.
And then there's that point where the fraud is kind of revealed and they realize you're pretty human and sometimes not a great human or whatever. What is it you think people need to think about in terms of making that connection? What advice do you give to people?
Yeah, and, you know, your point is so well taken. It's like when your kids are 7, they think you're the smartest person in the world. And when they're 14, they think you're the dumbest person in the world, that you don't know anything. And then by 21, all of a sudden, again, you're smart.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, it will change for the better. So what's the connection? That's a really great question. I think the thing is just to talk to your kids, to have the dialogue and find out what they're interested in, whether it's, you know, bowling or baseball or art or dance or choreography, whatever it is, and just to show an interest in your kid, go to that activity. Be there. Be an attentive parent without judgment. Do it just to be there, you know, supportive, and take an interest in their lives. And then have dialogues, have discussions. One of the things I found about baseball that works as a dialogue setter is that the game is, you know, slower compared to football or basketball. So there are natural pauses in the game, like between innings or between batters, where you can actually have a conversation with your kid. Hey, while we're waiting for the next batter to come up, who are you taking to the school dance next week?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to take Jane. And, you know, oh, really great. Tell me about that. You know, so you can actually get little tidbits of information out, and baseball actually serves as a good platform for that because of the time that's involved. But it doesn't matter. The activity is, the point is to be with your kid, to be interactive, to be involved, to be having conversations, discussions, and baseball just seemed to be the perfect platform for me.
How old are your kids now?
They're old. My daughter is 33.
He was a very young father, though.
Yeah. She's 33, and my son is 30, so they're growing up. My son is married now. My daughter has a longtime boyfriend. No rush to get married, you know, because millennials do it in a different way, different pace. But I'm
no
just really happy
there.
They have great relationships and great people, and they're both working and independent. So I feel like, I guess I must have done something right.
You did something right. Does your son ever bring up, you know, that time when you guys went on all these trips? I'm curious to know, as a 30-year-old, how he reflects back on that.
He reflects very positively on it. You know, it's, I think, a primal experience for him. And, of course, you know, the book is out there, and he's given it to people. He's been to some of my book signings along with my daughter. And so it's become sort of a family thing. And I'm hoping, you know, maybe one day I can write another book, you know, with my daughter based on what she's doing, which is podcasting and musicals and all that kind of fun stuff. And
she wrote a musical.
She wrote a musical.
That's cool.
Which she's very excited about. She's hired a composer who is putting all of her lyrics to music, and they're working on it now to try to get it on a podcast, hopefully in the spring.
That's very cool. I might know someone. all right, let me ask you a few rapid fire baseball questions.
Of course.
I know you need to like get out there and like bang down some doors or whatever it is you do. Best stadium.
Best stadium. Without a doubt, San Francisco. I love the Giants Park. It used to be AT&T Park. Now it has different names. You know, it goes by a new name every 2 years. But the view of the bay is panoramic. And the blue and the green and and people obviously love the garlic fries. They're really, really good. It's a great great venue to see a game. And the sight lines are terrific. I just love it. With a very close second, PNC Park in Pittsburgh, where the Pirates play, is also a fantastic overview. You can see the city skyline in the backdrop there, and people walk across the Roberto Clemente Bridge just to get to the game. And we took a watercraft to the game, one of those little water taxis, which was kind of fun. So that was a great experience too.
Best ballpark to drink a beer in?
Wow, that's a great great question. Mm. You know, if you go to St. Louis, it's all Busch beer and
yes,
Budweiser.
It is. You know?
So there's not a lot of variety there, but it's a good place. So I think that might be one of the favorites. San Francisco has a lot of craft beers, you know, because that's the thing now. So at some of the newer ballparks, you can get some of the craft beers.
Who has the best stunts, you know, like with a mascot?
That's a great question. In Milwaukee, they have wiener races.
Yes.
So they have a sauerkraut racing off against a hot dog against a, one of the other little characters. And they run around the outfield, and that's kind of a fun thing. That's a fun thing to see.
What's the worst stadium?
Unfortunately, I have to say Oakland. Actually, the second worst. Hmm. Because it's very old, and it just doesn't – it was built – originally for baseball, then they became a baseball football park with Mount Davis, which they built there for the Raiders. Now the Raiders are going away from that. But it just doesn't have the modern amenities in the field. But probably the worst is in Tampa Bay. The Rays play in an indoor stadium that has the atmosphere of a hospital. You know, it's very antiseptic. And it's like, you know, they're in the sunshine state and you never see the sunshine.
Right.
Because it's got a bubble over it. And it just feels like, you know, antiseptic.
Did you ever catch a home run?
Never caught a home run. I did get some foul balls. That's always been one of my dreams and goals in life, is one day to catch a home run.
Do you always bring a mitt?
I always bring a mitt.
Do you always dress the same way when you go to games?
I always have a baseball hat.
I
know
what it.
I have to do that. I have a mitt, and I'm ready to go. I'm into it. I'm pumped up.
Did you play baseball growing up?
I did. I played, in camp and such as that, and little league type competitions. I was really good when I was like 11, and then at 12 I couldn't hit the curveball, and that was the end of my career.
That happens. Well, I'm glad it didn't work out that way. I would never have met you. Favorite baseball movie?
Favorite baseball movie? Absolutely, Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. I love that. And that scene where Kevin Costner has the catch with his dad who comes out of the outfield, lots of tears on that.
You should go to that game next year.
I'm thinking about it.
You should.
The one in Iowa?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to do a Major League Baseball
yes.
game.
The Yankees
like
and the White Sox are going to be playing there at Field of Dreams in Dyersburg, Iowa, I think it is.
Yeah.
I want to go.
It's really, you should make that happen. That would be a great start to a new book.
It would. You never
just
know.
Saying. So the common theme in all of your life, I think, is just passion and mm-hmm. having passion for things. Mm-hmm. So what would you leave us with, maybe a challenge for people who sometimes feel like they don't have that passion? Is it because they haven't found it?
I think largely that's it. You know, a lot of people don't know what they want to do. I also, here's a little thing that a lot of people don't know about me, but I teach school as well.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I'm a part-time professor at Sac State. And I'm teaching Introduction to Public Speaking on Fridays, my day off. Derek's given me permission to do it, so it's all cool.
Derek's but my boss man. I did
yeah,
not know that. That's fantastic.
And I love it. I really, really love it. It's fun. And I bring it up only because the students will often say, I don't know what I want to do. You know, where do I go in life? How do I get my career goals going? They don't even have a major yet. And I try to counsel them that find something you're really enthusiastic about. Find something you enjoy, that you're energetic about, that you wake up in the morning, you can't wait to do. And that could be your pathway. That can be your venue, your opening pathway to find something, a career. And, you know, start with a major, something that you're interested in, whether it's, you know, government or politics or English or writing or history or mechanics, whatever it is. I try to guide them along the way in that venue to get them on the path that's going to lead to a good career path based on passion.
Because you just like it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just because you liked going down and throwing on the vinyl and talking about the next record.
Exactly. And I know for you, I've always admired your writing skills because you have been a great writer, always been a great writer. I've always looked at your scripts, you know, over the years, and I thought, this is so well crafted. Your descriptions are very poetic, very narrative.
Thank you.
And I imagine that writing was a passion for you.
Always. Yeah, always. All right, back to your book real quick. How do people find it?
Probably the easiest thing is through Amazon. You know, you can get it online. I think there's one copy left at Barnes & Noble at Arden Fair.
Well, maybe there'll be some more now. But you can find Baseball Between Us by Mike Lurie with his son, Matt Lurie. And then what are the best ways for people to keep up with you on social media?
So I have a Twitter account. It's KCRA Lurie, at KCRA Lurie. And then also through I have a Facebook page as well. And of course, emails, you know, through the station. I'm always looking for good story ideas and tips and things that can get us into some good stories that people want to know more about.
I hope somebody like sends you somewhere today and there's a guy playing the piano like that all the time. That'd be a good day.
Wouldn't that be fun?
It would be a really good day. All right. You can keep up with the show on Instagram at Dying to Ask Podcast. And you can follow me on Instagram at Run Read Sip. Thank you to everybody who's been going on and subscribing to the show and all those podcasty places. We appreciate it. And then if you leave those ratings and reviews, that is unlike with TV, which is weird, Mike, the way you grow podcasts is by people leaving ratings and reviews.
Really?
Yep. So you need the downloads, but then also when people go on there and say, man, that Mike Lurie, he's motivational. He changed my life, which maybe he did. He's probably just going to try to get your license plates. But that's what grows the show, so we appreciate it. Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm glad you still have my Iowa license plates.
I still do.
It makes me feel good.
I remember you every day.